Miami's fight against COVID, a debate between vaccinating people and tourism, and creating the music to the biggest show on Netflix. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami remains one of the hardest hit cities for COVID. What is the state doing to help? And how are folks getting vaccinated? Mayor Francis Suarez joins us and will answer your questions. Also, a look at tonight's college football championship game at Hard Rock Stadium. It usually means millions in revenue for the area. Is the county prioritizing tourism over vaccinating? And finally, The Queen's Gambit is one of the hottest shows on Netflix. We'll meet the composer. He's a professor at the University of Miami Frost School of Music. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Tonight is supposed to be one of the biggest nights in sports. It's the College Football National Championship, and it's happening at Hard Rock Stadium. The stadium will not be packed, but instead have a limited number of fans to protect against COVID. In previous years, a championship like with this would mean thousands of fans staying in Miami for days and lots of money for local businesses. Should that be our focus, or should it be stopping the virus from spreading further? We're joined now by Jose Sotolongo, Director of Sports and Entertainment for the Greater Miami Tourism and Convention Bureau. Jose, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Louis. How are you?
I'm doing good. Let me ask you this. Talk about the county's decision to continue to have the game at Hard Rock Stadium. I mean, you have a record number of people contracting the virus every day, and Hard Rock was supposed to be a vaccination site. Why continue with the game?
Well, those decisions aren't made by us, obviously. Those decisions are made by the county, by our leadership at the county level, and obviously with the NCAA and the college football playoff system. I will tell you this, though, that I was at the Orange Bowl game last week on the second. And that was my very first sporting event that I had attended in person since the pandemic began back in March. And I was pleasantly surprised. Inside the stadium, I was going from one section to another section. And there was a couple of young fans that were walking around, no masks on. And security made sure that they did put their mask on and did follow them to make sure that they didn't take it back off. So that to me was very much a positive inside the venue itself. I will tell you that the capacity to the stadium is about just a little over 13,000 folks that will be allowed in there for the game tonight. There is social distancing. I was very pleasantly surprised at the game last Saturday. I will not be there tonight, but I was at the game last Saturday, and pleasantly surprised.
You were at the game last Saturday, and did you feel safe?
Very much so. Very much so. I take very good care of myself for several reasons. Specifically, I have an almost 88-year-old mother that I have to take care of. I am her only link to groceries, to medical care, et cetera. So I need to be more careful than most people. I felt extremely safe at the game. There was social distancing. Now, obviously, people came up trying to get close to me, and I purposely said, you know, guys, please, 6-foot distance.
And those even friends of mine. The challenge with this is this, and just to play devil's advocate with you a little bit here, is this. Even with social distancing, even with masks, there's still a risk. And you're talking about even with 13 to 14,000 people, that's still, you know, there's a risk. There's always a risk involved. And so is there any fear that, you know, the optics will be really bad? Like, we're having a game in a county that has the worst numbers. We've seen the worst numbers since last summer. And now we have the worst, the new strain of the virus, which is getting worse than before, while we're struggling to vaccinate people. Is there a fear that it could look bad?
Well, I will put it to you this way, and I'm going to turn that around. The venue for the game tonight, Hard Rock Stadium, was the very first stadium to get a GBAC designation for cleaning and sanitizing of the venue itself. That that goes a very, very long way, being that the stadium is constantly being wiped down. All surfaces that can be touched are being wiped down. If you walk by the concession stand, you see the social distancing. You see folks being very careful there. I feel very confident that they are doing everything that can be done in order to mitigate any situations that might occur. Obviously, folks need to be as responsible as the stadium itself. And I do feel that, using the Orange Bowl game, which was played on the 2nd, as a barometer, if they follow the same advice and the same protocols that they followed during that game, I don't see any situation that would lead to anybody being concerned about any spikes in numbers coming from the game itself.
Your job is to encourage tourism in South Florida, especially with events like this. How do you market an event like this, knowing again that we're still smack in the middle of the worst part of this pandemic?
Well, the fact of the matter is that this game is marketed by not just ourselves. This game is marketed by the host committee. This game is marketed by the NCAA. Bottom line is that 13,000 seats are going to be used. The vast majority of them are going to be used by the two visiting teams. So folks from the University of Alabama, as far as the SEC, and then obviously Ohio State on the other side. Most of these folks are going to be coming to the game. We have certain hotels that are being used where we have good numbers of room blocks at a much smaller number of hotels, but still large numbers of room blocks within those properties themselves. Again, the hotels are being very careful as far as the protocols in order to make sure that nothing out of the ordinary happens, and that the main focus of this event is going to be shining a light on how beautiful Miami is. And bottom line, when this pandemic is over, and it will be over, this is not the end of humanity here, folks. This pandemic will be over, and the bottom line is that Miami will be here, and our staff, our city, our leaders, we're ready for whatever comes in the future in order to be handled the way we need it to be handled. And we are doing everything we can to make sure that we stay as safe as humanly possible.
You are right that the pandemic won't last, but we have seen travel pick up. We've seen air travel at the airports pick up. Tourists are coming. Snowbirds are coming. First of all, what is it you're seeing right now? What are you hearing? How many people are we seeing the kinds of numbers anywhere close to what we have seen before the pandemic?
Oh, no, we're not close to that yet. We are working and hopefully laying the groundwork in order to be able to take advantage of when this pandemic, when the numbers start going down, as we know they will. When the numbers start going down, we will be more than ready. Our community, our hotels, our restaurants, our attractions, and especially our airport. 96% of our travelers come in through Miami International. So we're doing everything we can, and we know we are ready, that once this is over, it'll be hopefully just a matter of just flipping a switch and being able to get those numbers back to where they were before. But now, we have the only airport in the United States that has over 100 airlines that service the airport. And we just announced recently, we being the community, Miami International announced service from Southwest Airlines and JetBlue that are going to be new airlines flying into the area. So we know that once we get the green light, that everything hopefully will be back to normal sometime soon. We know that we are going to be a major, major, major player in the industry.
Are you spending any money right now, though, marketing the area, or are you really trying to avoid that?
Well, it's a fine line that we have to draw here. I mean, obviously, we launched a program called Miami Shines when this whole pandemic started back about 10 months ago. Where we took advantage of using technology, and we worked with a lot of our partners and a lot of restaurants in the area where people would be able to order straight from the website, the restaurant's website, and be able to go pick up the food at the restaurant. Why did we do that? Very simple. And we didn't just do it with partners. We did it with pretty much every restaurant that wanted to participate, because we needed to make sure that people stayed employed. The industry here, obviously, the tourism industry is the number one industry in our community. And we knew we were going to get hit, and we did get hit severely. So we needed to do everything we could in order to be able to keep as many jobs going as possible at the time. And one of those was the creation of Miami Shines, where we are showing the community and showing showing the world, basically,
right,
that Miami is being very careful, and that we do have a lot of folks that work in this industry that need our own selves, our own community, to be able to go out. And you may not be able to go to a restaurant because you don't feel comfortable. But you know what? If you like XYZ restaurant,
right,
order from them, go pick it up from them, take it home. You enjoy the food, and the people at the restaurant have a job.
Let me ask you this. Especially at the beginning of this pandemic, there was a battle. There still is a battle between cities and counties and the state. And a lot of South Florida wanted to shut down or stay shut down for a while, again, because we had the bigger numbers. But the governor said, no, everybody's open. We got to be open for business. Was there pressure from Tallahassee to say, you're going to still have this game? You're going to open up business for business.
That question needs to be asked of the host committee, not of us.
Okay.
And I don't mean to pass the buck here, but no, we had no input into that whatsoever as to whether or not the game is going to be played.
I'm talking with Jose Sotolongo with the Greater Miami Tourism and Convention Bureau. Again, the college football championship game played tonight at the Hard Rock Stadium. Now, the stadium was being used as a vaccination site. Obviously, the vaccination site is put on hold until after the event. We have more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Fauci has said that it's going to take a large portion of the population to get the virus and to get the vaccine before we could even start to say we're going back to normal life. And that may not happen till the third quarter, he said. What do you think about that? And how long can our economy handle that?
That's a very good question. We hopefully we are over the hump, and we're heading towards much better news, hopefully very soon. That remains to be seen. We feel very confident. We've seen a lot of surveys here of sites and that folks around the world, once things are quote unquote.
Wait. You said you're confident, but again, the numbers are spiking, and you've seen the debacle in people trying to get vaccinated. There's not enough vaccinations going around right now. How are you confident?
Well, we're confident that in the future, if you notice what I said, I didn't say right now.
I did
say that in the future, once we are on the good side of the bell curve here, once we're there, we feel very confident in that we will be able to bring back tourism quickly to our community. Why? Because we continue to be one of those locations that people around the world want to visit. You constantly look at different surveys of different destinations that folks want to go to, and Miami is constantly pointing at the top. In the top portions of all those surveys.
What do you think about what Dr. Fauci said, that it could be until after summer?
I don't have any knowledge of what he said, so I could not comment on that.
Let me ask you this too. We're going to be talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez here in a moment, and he's been pushing for a change of the economy to more high tech. We also have seen, and we've talked about this debate in Miami Beach about changing the environment of Miami Beach to something more family friendly and getting rid of a lot of, your basically your spring breakers and changing that environment. What do you think about this idea? We even talked to an economist to talk about the pandemic may be a great time to get Miami and South Florida out of this service industry and out of the tourism industry into something different that's more stable with more high paying jobs. What do you think about changing the economy of South Florida?
Those decisions are made much higher than my pay grade. We've always been, tourism has always been at the top of the economic ladder, if you will, here in South Florida, not just here in Miami-Dade County, but all of South Florida, not all of Florida, to be honest with you. So there is a lot that we can do to keep tourism at the top and be able to work at the same time with a lot of the tech companies that hopefully will be moving here.
How much are we losing when you think about this game? you know, again, usually this is the championship game, right? The big game of the year. It's not as big as the Super Bowl, but still big. You know, usually you'd have a packed stadium. You'd have thousands of fans coming from both different communities, in this case, Alabama and Ohio State. And for at least a few days, they'd be here spending a lot of money. We're losing a lot, aren't we? How much are we losing?
That's a good question. The numbers for the Super Bowl were $532 million, I believe, was the official number of economic impact. This one, I've heard from different folks within the host committee that have said somewhere in the neighborhood of about $200 million in economic impact is still expected. So, you know, you can do the math right there. We're very happy that this game is going to provide not just obviously the local economy, but it's also think about how much airtime we're receiving from the different networks that are covering the game, and how much when you're up there, when you're up north and you're in Columbus, Ohio, let's say, and you're looking out your window and there's snow falling and the sky's gray and it hasn't been sunny in a few weeks up there, maybe a couple of months, and you're looking out here in South Florida and we're shivering when the temperatures are in the 50s here, and they'd give their left arm to be able to have temperatures in the 50s.
No, that's so, I agree with you on that. That's
we're
true.
We're going to receive hundreds of millions of dollars of comparable airtime. So we know that that's a good thing for us, and you can't put a value on that. I mean, you guess at how much money that would be that we would be receiving, but it's a very good chunk of change that we'll be receiving in free publicity.
How much time do you guys spend talking to health officials, though? Because I just wonder, like, you know,
we're not the game itself.
Not the game. Anything in general. Just talk about tourism in general, but just saying. You know, do you speak?
Again, I handle sports tourism.
okay.
Sports related, please feel free to ask me, and I'd be more than happy to answer.
No,
but when it comes to questions like that, again, that's beyond my pay grade.
I understand. All right. So again, for tonight's game, it's going to be limited seating, limited capacity. I think we've gotten kind of used to watching games like that now. But you know, again, just remind us, what is the stadium doing to protect people? What are the procedures in place?
From personal experience, I will tell you, there is no tailgating. Let's start with that. Let's start with a normal fan experience. You get in your car for the most part and you drive into the stadium. Okay. That's where it starts. That's where the change starts. There is no tailgating at the stadium. And that is done simply to prevent people from congregating and not following the social distancing protocol. That's number one. Number two, you get to the stadium and you get to the gate. They take everyone's temperature at the gate once you're going to walk in. And once you're inside, you go to your seats, and the seats are in different, and they're calling them pods, P-O-D-S, pods of two and pods of four and pods of six. And what they're doing is they're keeping families together. Say you're a family of four, you have a pod of four. You are socially distanced from everybody, from the next seat holder. Is going to be, and I don't know the exact amount of seats, but they're X amount of seats away from you. And the seats, it's not like they have a little sign that says, don't sit here. No, they're actually covered so that you cannot sit there and you cannot congregate in more than the pod that you're sitting in. That's number one. Number two, there are hand cleaning stations and sanitizing stations all over the stadium. There are I like to call them the mask police, walking around making sure that everybody's wearing their masks. If they're not, they're asked to put their mask on. And if they don't, then they're graciously escorted off the property. The food concession stands are all socially distanced. Nothing. There's plexiglass everywhere. And I wish I'd have been in the plexiglass business when this whole thing started. I'd be sitting somewhere enjoying myself. But anyway, long story short, they are being very, very careful at the stadium. Again, I mentioned earlier that the Hard Rock Stadium was the very first stadium that was given the GBAC designation as far as cleanliness. So we're very confident that they're going to be doing a good job. If you happen to watch the game on TV, I think you'll notice that the folks will be wearing masks in the stands. And that people will be socially distanced. There's no other option for them at the stadium.
Yeah. Now, again, we're used to watching the games now, football games, where there are some fans in the stands and they are socially distanced. sometimes they have that mask slips a little bit, but maybe there's somebody there to remind them. Hopefully that's the case. And again, as you mentioned, it is limited to barely over 13,000 people right. in a stadium that holds more than 65,000. So hopefully that won't be the case. But again, this it's tricky. Jose Sotolongo again with the Greater Miami Tourism and Convention Bureau. Again, the college football championship game being played tonight at Hard Rock Stadium. That's at 8 o'clock. It's between Alabama and Ohio State. Again, as I mentioned, if you want to know, because you may have the question, yes, that was a vaccination site. It will be again after the event is over. You can go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, to get the latest. Jose, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. All the best to you.
All right. Thank you. Well, still to come. How is Miami handling the spread of COVID and making sure that people get vaccinated? Miami Mayor Francis Suarez finally joins us. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We are in a new year, but health officials from the CDC want people to remember, hey, we're still battling this pandemic. There are a lot of challenges to getting people vaccinated, and even if we do, we still have to wear our masks and keep socially distanced for a while. As we continue this battle, people are trying to get back to work, they're trying to get back to normal, and we're wondering, when is the economy going to catch back up? Well, joining us now is the City of Miami Mayor, Francis Suarez. Mayor Suarez, welcome to the program.
Louis, it's a pleasure and an honor to be with you as always.
I wanted to start with this. I know that you have the State of the City address coming up soon, but speaking of COVID first, what is the current state of COVID cases in Miami in general and also with the hospitals within the city limits?
Well, there are two separate issues. You know, we in the summer had a daily high of about 3,500 new cases per day. We have vacillated in the 2,500 to 3,000 new case per day area for the last few weeks. The good news is that while in the summer we had a high of hospitalizations of 2,300, we're at about 1,150. So even though we're approximating the same number of new cases per day, we have about 50% less hospitalization. So that's allowed us to manage the hospital portion of this pandemic much, much better. And I think that's due to better therapeutics, understanding how to treat people better, and so we're fortunate in that sense.
Now you've extended the state of emergency, from 2020. How long do you see that still being in play?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I was having the conversation today as I signed the document. I think number one, obviously, we're still testing, we're still dealing with the effects of the virus. Secondly, we now are in a mass vaccination program, which we're not even sure how long it will take because our main limitator is actually getting vaccine. So we can only administer what we get. And so assuming that we get vaccine in the amounts that is needed to vaccinate the general public quickly, then we hope that that vaccine obviously works and that the caseload goes from the area that it's in to virtually nothing. And I think that's the point at which, which the state of emergency will be lifted. But we're going to start having those conversations soon.
And remind us what that state of emergency entails and what power does that give you and what you do?
The state of emergency does a variety of things. I think it is something that for contracting purposes, for procurement purposes, that allows us to bypass some of the regular procurement procedures so that if we had to, on an emergency basis, buy PPE or, recently we had to procure through the CARES Act, gift cards that we help distribute to members of our community that were in need. It allows us to be much more efficient with some of the decisions that we make. So I think that's one of the main things that it does. I think the other one is it's for private contracts. You know, when people talk about force majeure, in a private contract, acts of God. I mean, this, the state of emergency is something that is often used as a force majeure provision. So it also helps people in the private sector be able to better manage their affairs, their contractual affairs, understanding the government has taken an official position on how we're dealing with this emergency.
And when you talk about procurement, does that also include vaccines?
Vaccines, you know, the big issue would be, you know, distribution. So we don't procure vaccine. The vaccine is going to be given to us by the state of Florida. It's actually allotments that are given to them by the federal government. So we're not actually having to buy vaccine, thankfully. And where we have cost is in the administration part, right? So we obviously have, you know, most likely going to have firefighters and maybe some other medical personnel that we're going to need to contract with or to pay overtime to make sure that we have the throughput necessary to not only vaccinate everyone who we get a vaccine for, but potentially escalate that very, very quickly if President-elect Biden does what he says he's going to do, which is to release a significant amount of vaccine in the next few days.
And what about with that distribution? What other places can you be distributing that vaccine? Would Marlins Park be a vaccination site?
It is. We do have that planned. For Marlins Park to be a vaccination site. We also are looking at a variety of other sites, one that was a prior testing site in Hadley, and we're looking at other sites like Curtis Park and others, depending on whether or not we can get enough throughput there. What we want to have is sites that can do probably no less than 1,000 vaccinations per day. And again, like I said, that's all limited by our the receipt of vaccine by the city.
So a lot of this that you're going through, like any city or county, it's dependent on the work, the cooperation you get from the state. And, right. You know, you were having trouble communicating with the governor. I wonder, has he ever responded? Have you two spoken?
We haven't, unfortunately, spoken. And, you know, frankly, it was really based more on mitigation factors and the coronavirus task force report that said that we as a state were not mitigating enough and that we as a local government needed the tools to be able to mitigate. Those were what those conversations were about. I'm going to try him again because there are a variety of other concerns that we need to talk about, not just on the vaccination front, but on the security front, given what may happen over the next 9 days or so. We want to make sure that we're coordinating and communicating because, heaven forbid, we may need the state's intervention and involvement, which I doubt will happen. We want to have a clear line of communication. The good news is, Lewis, that I've had great communication with cabinet-level members of his, like Jared Moskowitz, who's done a magnificent job. He's the director of emergency management, the CIO, who's done a phenomenal job. So I have been able to talk to some members of his team that are critical to what we're doing.
Can you tell me real quickly, why do you think Moskowitz has done a tremendous job? How?
You know, he's very responsive. He's very innovative. You know, he is someone who is not afraid to make tough decisions. Oftentimes we find in government people who shy away from making difficult decisions, and he's been very proactive. So that's been my experience with him.
And yeah, just to point out that, you know, as we've said on this on air many times, the rollout of the vaccine has been short of a success. It's kind of in many ways a failure.
By the way, I would agree with that. But, you know, again, there's a lot of things that I think conspire to make that so, right? First of all, you cannot vaccinate people if you don't have vaccine. So I think part of the failure starting all the way from the top, from the federal government, was I think they put a lot of emphasis and energy on developing a vaccine, which is wonderful. It's great. You definitely need to have a vaccine before you can distribute it. But I'm not so sure that a lot of time and energy was spent on the distribution network. And so I think now everyone is just sort of scrambling. And what we want to do in the city is, to the extent that they give us vaccine, we want to be prepared to receive it, administer it, and be a partner in that process.
Yeah. The other thing, too, briefly, is, look, that's the relationship you have with the state. But the other thing, of course, is the relationship you have with other cities and the county. You had a tenuous relationship with a former mayor, Carlos Jimenez. What is that like now with Miami Mayor Daniela Levine Cava?
It's great. We have a great relationship. We speak often, almost daily. You know, I find her to be very collaborative in her personality and, you know, someone who's not an ego-driven person and, you know, and understands the value of that collaboration. You know, there's a value to the perception of the ability to collaborate that is as important almost as actual collaboration. And I think, you know, she understands that. And so far, it's been very, very good. We've done a lot of things together, and we're hoping that that continues.
Again, talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, talking about how the city is dealing with COVID, how the city is handling the issue of vaccines. And I want to talk now about the economy, because that is the other thing that's been hit pretty hard because of the pandemic. Mayor, you've got your state of the city. Yep. I know you're an optimistic guy, but come on. Your city got hit really, really hard. Yeah. And we're still waiting to see when we're going to bounce back. We don't know. A lot of people are traveling again, even though health officials say not a smart idea. Plus, the new strain of the virus is in Florida now. What is the state of the city? What are you feeling right now?
Well, you're right. I am an optimistic guy, and I am a very positive guy. But I also am realistic, and I do understand that, you know, this 2020 has been a year that nobody ever could have contemplated. I mean, if you were to tell me as a mayor, right, in terms of your mayoral training or mayoral scorecard, that you'd have a year where you had civil disturbances, a global pandemic, and the most active hurricane season, one of the most active hurricane seasons in recorded history, I would say, wow, that was a really loaded year. I think having said all of that, I think the city has weathered that storm very well, given all that, you know, given all those challenges. For example, our government, we had a projected $25 million deficit. We ended the year with only a $2 million deficit, so almost basically with a balanced budget. We've maintained a high credit rating. We've maintained adequate reserves, but we have been delayed in some of the things that we would have liked to have spent the year focusing on. For example, affordable housing. It would have been great if we would have been able to spend a little more time and energy on affordable housing this year. It would have been great if we would have been able to spend a little more time and energy on some of our climate projects. But obviously, we were dealing with pandemics.
So I want to ask you about this, because one of the things you are putting focus on is, recently anyway, is trying to lure tech companies to Miami. With everything you're dealing with, why put some energy on that?
Because one of the big issues we have in this community is income inequality. And you can't address income inequality if you don't create high-paying jobs. I mean, if there's another way to do it, I'd love for someone to call me and tell me what it is. But I think the first thing you have to do is you have to attract high-paying jobs into our community, number one. Number two, you have to be honest about where is our economy today and where is it going tomorrow. I have a six-year-old and a two-and-a-half-year-old. I can barely get my six-year-old off the iPad. You know, everything that we do is tech-oriented. So if any mayor in any city, in not only the U.S. but in the world, doesn't understand that they need to be growing their tech ecosystem, they're not only doing a disservice to their generation, they're doing a disservice to their children's generation and their unborn grandchildren.
Is it about that ecosystem? Or because we talked to community expert Richard Florida, and he said this about the pandemic: this may be a good time for Miami to reconsider rebuilding its entire economy and getting away from tourism and service to an extent and putting more effort into high-tech, high-paying jobs. What do you think about that? Is this a time to reshape the whole city?
Absolutely. I totally agree with Richard Florida's perspective on this. I think we need to diversify, maybe not reshape, but diversify. And when you look at investing, right, and you have a portfolio, you want to put your investments in different kinds of industries so that if something goes bad on one, it doesn't affect the entire portfolio. And I think for me, when I was 20 years old, if you were, wanted to go to a great school, you had to leave Miami, first of all, to go to an Ivy League caliber school. Then if you wanted to get a great job where you could, provide for your family, oftentimes you have to stay away. And my message to the families that live in my city is I'm going to fight day in and day out to create an economy where your children don't have to leave for school and don't have to leave to work, right? They can provide for their families right here in the city of Miami. And then the second part of it is we have to make sure that that's something, to the extent that we can control it, that is equitable, right? We have to make sure that the children in our community, all of them, have an equal opportunity to get an incredible education, have the digital tools that they need to be competitive, and have other tools such as broadband that create inequalities throughout cities in the country. So that's my challenge.
All right, I'm going to get one question in that did come in from Twitter. I'm going to see if I can get it in here. We got one. I don't know who wrote this in, but it came in on our Twitter. How soon can we expect vaccination options for seniors who cannot leave their homes due to the lack of transportation and disability?
Well, the first thing we need to do is get vaccination. So we probably are not going to get vaccination, my understanding, this week. We're hopeful to get it next week. And the way we did it with testing was, you know, homebound seniors were the priority. So I presume that with vaccinations, there will be a similar program where homebound seniors who cannot get out will have an ability. We will go to them as we did with testing.
He is City of Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. Mayor Suarez, always a pleasure. We'll stay in touch because we've got a lot going on as we jump into 2021.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. And again, you can continue to find more information, as the Twitter question asked. I mean, you can find more information, again, on vaccinations and testing on our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, the story of an orphan prodigy chess player is blowing up on Netflix. We're going to meet the composer of the show, Queen's Gambit. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. That is from the Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit, one of the most talked about series online. It reached more than 60 million viewers in its first month. The show follows the story of Beth Harmon, an orphan chess prodigy in the 1960s. She battles drug and alcohol dependency as well as misogyny. University of Miami Frost School of Music professor Carlos Rafael Rivera scored the soundtrack for the show. That, again, what we've been listening to throughout the program today, and he joins me now. Carlos, welcome to the program.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Luis.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure to have you. I got to tell you, as watching the show, I'm enthralled. I am totally into this. And I think part of it is I wish I was a chess player, but I'm not that good. And I just think that I love they really recreated that this vision of this world in the 1960s. When you first read the teleplay for the series, what did you make of the story?
Well, I actually received an email from the director, Scott Frank, about 2 years ago. And he said, the subject line was The Queen's Gambit. And he said, this looks like the next thing we may be doing for Netflix. And so what I did is, the teleplay hadn't been written yet, so I went and bought the novel by Walter Tevis and devoured it like in about a day. And began writing music immediately, and I was very concerned that, based on the game and how much time was spent describing the games in the novel, that we were going to have quite a challenge to kind of make chess interesting.
So wait a second, you started thinking of the music right after you read the book, not even before you even saw the teleplay?
Oh yeah, always, yeah. The source is everything for me.
So for you, as you're thinking about this, look, again, the show takes place in the 1960s, and it does a beautiful job of the clothing, the vernacular, the ambiance, everything hitting that era. But, you know, again, you're starting to write this from the book. What was the decision to go with a more classical score? Was it the game of chess? Was it the era? Was it the drama of this young girl? What was the main thing for you?
Well, personally, there's sort of two answers to it. There's like the personal motivator, and then there's what the director decides, which is what you ultimately do. And they happen to be simpatico this time. And the fact is that it felt like classical music was going to be needed, because the novel actually mentions a lot more classical music. It even sometimes describes the chess games as it was like chamber music. Literally, I think that's one of the quotes from the novel. And also there's a moment when she's kind of left behind and some friends go to, some college friends that she kind of meets and has a party. And one of the evenings, the next morning, they go away. In the show, appropriately, she ends up listening to pop music because it helps establish the time. But in the novel, she listens to Vivaldi. So as I read it, I realized, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble, because I'm going to have to write a music or the feel of it is going to have to be classical. And it truly lends itself, because it's very linear writing. This point and counterpoint, which made me feel of a move and a countermove in the game and the gameplay itself.
Yeah, let's take a listen to this piece. This is early on in the show, in the first episode, when our main character Beth starts playing chess in the basement of her school. Thank you. And again, the visuals are so beautiful. But, you know, as a composer, and I'm wondering, you know, the conversations that you had with the director, Scott Frank, about, you know, this particular scene and what you're trying to create. He's creating the set with the lighting. And again, this dark, dank room with this young girl and this older man and a chessboard. But what are you trying to create?
Well, this actual piece that you're playing is actually from the end of the show. And the music's called, the piece is called Sigrayim. And it's actually...
Oh, my apologies. Yeah.
No, that's fine. I think it's cool because it kind of sets up a good contrast. And what's interesting is that some of the first music I wrote that is the one you're actually playing, I wrote that piece when the novel was, when the teleplay hadn't been written. And this was always a piece I felt of like Beth's redemption, if anything, or character redemption. And as I wrote that piece and the show started to come together, the actual scene you mentioned, which was the basement and the beginning of her story, was the result of choices that were made for her as a child. And so it's very dark, and the music had to kind of reflect that.
Yeah.
But this music, well, I never thought would be used until I saw the final sequence of the show, which is, you know, towards the end. It's almost like a coda scene.
Yeah.
And that, I presented it to Scott again because he had heard it 2 years before. And he goes, oh, my gosh, I think it could work. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I think he's going to use it, which was very exciting for me because
yeah.
I really felt very connected. This music that you're hearing has nothing to do with the rest of the show. And that's why I wasn't sure if it was going to make it, but it feels like refreshing, if anything.
Yeah, my apologies, we played the wrong piece. But you know what? I wanted to know, the other thing is, how much autonomy do you have in the process?
None.
Ah.
Dun, dun, dun. No. It would be great to say, you know, I've just like, you know, I have incense and I wear a robe and I kind of get creative. The truth is that it is a service industry. And what we're doing is we're servicing the story. And the director is our leader, and we all are kind of gathered together to kind of help that vision become real, whether it's the set design, which I love the fact that you mentioned that, and the costumes and the cinematography and the editing and sound design actually plays such a large role in the experience that kind of uplifts, that you find uplifting, or if anything, engaging as a story. And so I will write a lot of music, and because I have an unorthodox relationship with Scott in the sense that, you know, I am on board really before even the screenplay is completely written, and I'm writing music to kind of help him see things through. Sometimes it influences scenes, and it's a real thrill for me to get to do that.
Again, I'm talking with Carlos Rafael Rivera, professor at the Frost School of Music and the composer behind the hit Netflix limited series, The Queen's Gambit. Again, we've included more about the series and Carlos's work on our social media, so check it out at WLRN Sundial. This, as I keep mentioning, is like the most popular show on Netflix. In Netflix history, 62 million estimated viewers tuning in to watch the first month. Why do you think a show about an orphan chess player is resonating so well with people today?
I really wish I had an eloquent answer. I think all of us are as surprised. I had a really strong feeling that the chess community would respond well to the show because I know how much love and care was taken by Scott and the team to kind of, they worked with Bruce Pandolfini and Garry Kasparov, one of the greats, to make sure that the gameplay was accurate and reflective, as accurate as it can be in storytelling, to kind of be okay with the community. And so I was excited about the community engaging, like almost like a niche story that Netflix would release. I had no clue that I would be getting to talk to you about this at all.
And so I'd imagine, I mean, as a professor, how do you use this with your students? How does this become a teaching tool?
Oh, it's one of the great thrills of my life. I've been teaching for like 20 years, at least in academia, and starting at USC in 98, I started teaching. And in 2010, I moved to the University of Miami, and I've been actually director of the media writing production program for the last 5 years. And so I get to teach. I feel like I get to teach this, you know, because I'm a fan of this. Ultimately, I do this outside of my quote unquote day job, but my day job is as part of what I do as possible. And I get to bring back, you know, what's currently happening and best practices from the quote unquote, I never thought I'd say quote unquote 70 times in one interview. So I apologize already. but from the battlefield of writing, you know, like I'm in the trenches and I come back and I tell them, listen, these are all the mistakes I've made. I screwed up here. I messed up here. I made a mistake here. This is, I highly advise it against trying to do this as you're working on your storytelling skill set and through music.
And I'd imagine too, like anything in life, because as you said, look, these bigger projects, these are collaborations with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm wondering like that lesson for students, like what do you tell them about, you know, how to interpret a director's instructions and the writer's desire and the producers, you know, what they want. I mean, what do you tell them about how to prepare for that?
I think we do spend an awful lot of time talking about the psychology of this and mostly the fact that, as I said earlier, that I am in service of, if I understand my role in this part, in this game, I will probably have a good chance to succeed, at least see it through to the end. And that is really that you're servicing the story. I think a lot of folks that come into film scoring have, you know, they read John Williams or Jerry Goldsmith, the older guard, and or Alexander Desplat, and they go, oh, they must come in and command the room and just make decisions. And the truth is that all of them are serving the director's story. I also noticed very much the classical composers, because I have a classical background. So I was commissioned works and I would write a piece of music and there it is. It's submitted and you can hopefully play it. And I'd be grateful for that. But the difference for classical composers coming into this medium is that they're not used to rejection in that way. That, you know, I've given you a piece of music. Why don't you play it? Well, yeah. In this world, it's like, I've given you a piece of music and they're like, I don't like it. And they're like, but it's great. And they're like, yeah, it could be great, but for another director, not for me.
Not for that. Yeah. Wait, so, you know what? I wanted to listen to a little bit of this, the main theme. And as we are, I wanted to get a sense from you again, you know, right, how you were trying to, what you were trying to create, but then also that process of when you're trying to convince the directors, like this is what I see. This is what I hear. What was that conversation like? And again, this is, I believe, this is the main theme.
This is the main title, yeah. This is.
So tell me a little bit about how, you know, the process of creating this, and was it an easy sell?
This was actually, but the longer version is that it was not quite an easy sell, but the short version is that it made it to the end. So I'm very happy about that. And it originally was approved by Scott at the end of 2018 as the screenplay was being finished. He hadn't shot anything yet, and I knew this would be the main title. I felt it, really. And I submitted and it lived for a while in that sort of idea. And the principle behind it was that this, I'm, you know, like in opera, there's always an overture. And, you know, the overture presents all these little themes that you're going to be encountering, right? Like think of Bizet's Carmen, like very famous overture. Well, this idea was to have this. And since it was going to play at the end of the story and the end of episode 7, you hear this for the first time. The idea was to kind of do like a, I don't know about the culinary stuff, but you know when you have like a deconstructed bistec empanizado, and or like a deconstructed Cuban sandwich, and they give you a little piece of bread and maybe an olive and ham and separated. Well, the idea was to present all of this material throughout the story that would be building and building until we reached here. So all of the themes for most of the characters are in that little 2-minute sequence that you're playing in the background.
You know, I was thinking about this, like the future. For musicians, because again, as you're teaching these students, you know, it's you're preparing them for the world. And obviously with the pandemic, one of the challenges is live performances, you know, have been put on hold for a while. But, you know, one of the things that really blew up was obviously, you know, a lot of Netflix, a lot more movies, video games as well. And I know there's a lot of music in that as well. What do you tell the students about the future? Where are the best opportunities for them?
I'm always hopeful. I'm always optimistic because I am in a position of teaching. If I wasn't teaching, I wouldn't be able to give you an answer. I think that would be at least what I felt adequate. or I give you an answer that I felt was adequate for my inexperience with them. But the fact is that students have so much more game than I did when I was a student. And they come in, they really come in with so many ideas that I'm like, oh my gosh, how'd you come up with that? And so I am ultimately the learner. I always do feel that. And I feel our job is to help our students become better than us. And through the mistakes I make in the workplace of this writing for media journey that I'm in, I get to share with them these things and they hopefully take those. When you're young, you're probably not going to listen to everything. You'll feel like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then you hit the wall by yourself, I guess, as we all do. Mm-hmm. But at least I feel like I get to present them the opportunity for that. And the truth is the field has exploded in the last few years. And obviously for the worst reasons possible, the pandemic. And so content consumption has grown exponentially, and they are making it as fast as they can. So yeah. I think there is a thriving industry and opportunities for those who are entrepreneurial enough to find them.
Carlos Rafael Rivera, professor at the Frost School of Music and the composer behind the hit Netflix limited series, The Queen's Gambit. Fascinating show it really is, and the music is absolutely beautiful. Carlos, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you. What a thrill to get to meet you. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, definitely. And again, I will say it. I love the show. I am totally hooked on it. Well, that is Sundial for this Monday, January 11th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, South Beach is seeking to change its identity from a party town to a much more exclusive city. Will COVID-19 be the opportunity that city leaders were hoping for? Plus, a fight over federally protected wetlands is underway between the state and the Miccosukee tribe. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. Talk to you live tomorrow.